When Barack Obama announced when he was running for president that his purpose was to transform American society, being a lifelong socialist, what he really meant was to try to transform America into a European-style welfare state, which is essentially an even bigger and more pervasive welfare state than we already have. We already had a gigantic, gargantuan welfare state when he took office, but he wanted to go much further at exactly the time when the European welfare states are all collapsing and have been for many years. And so, but for a long time, for decades, there's been a major element in American politics that has always sort of taken advantage of the rational ignorance of the American public by saying, well, we should be more like Europe. France does it this way, or Sweden does it that way. Germany does it this way. We should be more like the Europeans, with the understanding that the average American citizen knows little or nothing about the European welfare states and is not inclined to spend much time educating themselves about it. They're what economists call rationally ignorant about most things regarding public policy and in their own country, let alone other countries. And so that's been the game for a long, long time, and we are headed in that direction in the United States. As I said, right at the time when a lot of the European welfare states have utterly collapsed with riots and bankruptcy and bailouts and so forth. And so that's the agenda for tonight, the myth of the successful European welfare state. And I started out by putting an article by Ludwig Erhard. Ludwig Erhard was the finance minister of Germany after World War II. He had been an anti-Nazi, and so even though he was a German, he was on the side of the Allies, so-called, during World War II. And he was also trained in Austrian economics. And so he became the finance minister and then eventually chancellor. And so the first thing that he did that he became really famous for was at the end of World War II, the American occupation authorities, since Keynesianism and fascism were sort of the reigning ideas on the economic front at the time, economic fascism and Keynesianism, they thought that they would just keep almost all of the Nazi economic regulations in place, including pervasive price controls, because that, after all, is what the New Deal was. What Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal was, pervasive government-imposed prices. And so, and Ludwig Erhard, though, had been schooled in economics, and he understood that this was an utter disaster to have price controls that hold the price down below pre-market prices, because you stimulate demand while restricting supply by reducing or eliminating profit in producing additional supply, thereby creating shortages of just about everything. And so he went on the radio on a Sunday and just announced on the radio all over Germany that no more price controls, abolishing price controls. And that was the start of the so-called German economic miracle. And so and that's what he became really famous for. And then he also became an opponent of the growing impetus toward a bigger and bigger welfare state in the 1950s. And of course, the welfare state, in a big way, is credited with being started first by Otto von Bismarck, the German chancellor in the late 19th century. And in fact, it's even called Bismarckism, and even still today in some circles. And so Germany had a welfare state, but it was on the road to becoming greatly expanded, as it was in many other countries, including the United States, after the 1930s, after the so-called New Deal years in the 1930s in this country, in the United States. And so so Erhard became a big critic. And I thought it'd be very interesting to take a look at some of the things he was saying, and because they were so true, they were so prescient, and it's a good illustration of how just a little basic understanding of economics and economic incentives can help you understand of such things as the consequences of a massive transformation in society from a society based on private enterprise, individual responsibility, limited government, to an economy based on unlimited government subsidies for everyone and no one being responsible for anything, which is essentially what the welfare state philosophy is. And so one of the first things Earhart did was to start warning about the moral hazard problems that would be created by an expanded welfare state. And because he understood that in a private enterprise economy with a minimal or non-existent welfare state, people are responsible for themselves and their families, and therefore they have to develop some sort of work habits, a sense of responsibility, understanding that you are responsible for your actions, positive and negative, and so forth. But once you get on the road of enlarging the welfare state, you whittle away at those things. You whittle away at individual responsibility and the work ethic. And so he warned about that from the very beginning. And he also made the pitch for not going down the road of raising taxes to excessive levels to pay for a welfare state, because he was addressing his opponents. He was saying, even if you want a big welfare state, you have to understand that you need a growing economy to finance all of these utopian dreams that you might have. He was saying to his political opponents and his intellectual opponents. And so, and that, of course, is very, very, very true. And he made this one statement that he pointed out that economic freedom is incompatible with, quote, social insurance. Economic freedom is totally incompatible with social insurance. So he was pretty much an anarchist on the issue of welfareism, was Ludwig Erhard. And Germany had just gone through hyperinflation. And so one of the comments that Erhard made was that currency stabilization is really the first objective, that you can't have a growing economy or a welfare state if you have an unstable currency, by which he meant an inflated currency that would put Germany back on the road to hyperinflation. And the biggest warning he gave, I guess, is he talked about a flight from responsibility. And this is a theme throughout all the critics of welfare, I suppose, especially Earhart, and including Friedrich Hayek. And when I reread this a little passage from Earhart about how a welfareism would create a flight from responsibility, it reminded me of a chapter of this book by Hayek, The Constitution of Liberty. And one of the chapters of The Constitution of Liberty, Chapter 5, is called Responsibility and Freedom. Chapter 5 of The Constitution of Liberty. And here's, so I thought I'd take a moment to read what Hayek says on the first page of this. This is page 71 of his book, The Constitution of Liberty. Liberty not only means that the individual has both the opportunity and the burden of choice, it also means that he must bear the consequences of his actions and will receive praise or blame for them. Liberty and responsibility are inseparable. A free society will not function or maintain itself unless its members regard it as right that each individual occupy the position that results from his action and accepts it as due to his own action. And Hayek goes on to say that the socialists and totalitarians of all kinds, no matter what they call themselves, whether they call themselves fascists, socialists, communists, or whatever, have always waged war on individual responsibility. That's always been the first target of any collectivist. Because if there's widespread agreement that we are responsible for our actions, well, that blows out of the water the whole idea that we need a welfare state, because the fundamental premise behind a welfare state is that bad things happen to people that are of have nothing to do with their own behavior. That if you're poor, it's just an accident of history, for example. And if you're rich, it's an accident of history as well. And so there's no cause and effect between behavior and the results in life. And so Hayek goes on to continue. I'll read a couple more sentences. He says, this belief in individual responsibility, which has always been strong when people firmly believed in individual freedom, has markedly declined together with the esteem for freedom. Responsibility has become an unpopular concept, a word that experienced speakers or writers avoid because of the obvious boredom or animosity with which it is received by a generation that dislikes moralizing. Now, he was writing this in the 1960s. And to continue, he says, it often evokes the outright hostility of men who have been taught that it is nothing but circumstances over which they have no control that has determined their position in life or even their actions. This denial of responsibility is, however, commonly due to a fear of responsibility, a fear that necessarily becomes also a fear of freedom. Okay, and then the final sentence is, it is doubtless because the opportunity to build one's own life also means an unceasing task, a discipline that man must impose upon himself if he is to achieve his aims, that many people are afraid of liberty. Now, they're afraid of liberty because you have to work. It requires self-discipline and work to succeed under a regime of liberty, Hayek said, and that's one reason why so many people are opposed to liberty. And I've told friends over the years, for example, that the one type of article that results in my getting all sorts of hate mail, they're hate mail, really vicious, vitriolic denunciations, is whenever you write something and come out in favor of economic freedom, you know, eliminating price controls or free markets in general. Even more than some of my controversial writings on LinkedIn, things like that, you start getting a reputation for writing in defense of economic freedom, and you'll get the same kind of hate mail that I've been getting for 30 years or so. And I just ignore it all, but it really is telling that there are so many people who hate the idea of living as a free person. And I think it was Aristotle who once said some people are natural slaves, and maybe he was right about that. And so getting back to what Earhart was predicting, really, he also said the quest for security is an illusion because, of course, there's never any guarantee for security. And I think he was understanding the moral hazard effect of welfare statism here, and that the bigger the welfare state, the smaller is the private sector, the smaller is the sector that produces wealth and income for all uses, as well as to finance the welfare state. And so if you kill the goose that lays the golden egg, so to speak, it's an illusion to think that you can have an ever-expanding welfare state. And he mentioned, so, you know, he forecast some of the effects of the welfare state. And effect number one, he said, was socialization of income. And this really did come with the income tax. In any country that adopted income taxation, one of my favorite old books on income taxation is The Income Tax, Root of All Evil by Frank Chodorov. And he was an old writer, Frank Chodorov. And in one of the passages there, he points out that one of the effects of the passage of the income tax amendment in the United States was it established the idea, essentially, that all income is to be nationalized. It's no longer your property. It's now the property of the government. And the government will tell you how much of that property that you get to keep by setting the income tax rate. If it were to set the income tax rate at a flat 50%, then it is saying, well, you can keep half, and we, the politicians, will keep half. And so we essentially nationalized all income by adopting the income tax, at least for the people who pay the income tax. And Earhart was warning about that. He warned about central planning or social engineering run amok under welfare statism, and that certainly is true. Just in the United States, we have hundreds of welfare state programs of all kinds. He warned against dependence on the state and the deterioration of capital markets because of the massive diversion of capital from being used to produce goods and services and in a way that would also increase labor productivity, as it always does, capital investment. And of course, when you increase labor productivity, you increase wages as well in the economy. So there's a massive diversion away from that to the eating up of capital by spending on current consumption. And like I said, he was trained in Austrian economics, and so he understands the essential importance of capital markets. And so the politicization of capital markets will lead to more and more poverty, is what he was saying. And that is exactly what has happened. Because, of course, you know, the banks are not perfect. Bankers are not perfect by any means. But in a free market, if you allow capital markets to work, then credit is allocated according to credit worthiness of the various businesses. Businesses that seem most likely to produce goods and services that please their customers, they will earn profits from those businesses, and those profits will be used to pay off the loans from the banks. And so, and vice versa, those businesses that don't seem likely to please their consumers, their customers very well, will have a tougher time getting credit. And that's, you know, one of the ways in which capital markets work. But once you politicize capital markets, it's the decision regarding who gets credit will be based on whoever can provide the most votes to the politicians in Washington. And it just has nothing whatsoever to do with economic viability of different enterprises. And I think that's the sort of thing that Earhart was warning about. Now the Swedish welfare state has always been held up. Not always, but since the 1950s, anyway, has been held up as sort of the ideal for America, you know, the ideal welfare state system. Every time it seems successful in any way, there are reams of articles, of books written by intellectuals, academics of the left about the wonders of Swedish socialism or the Swedish welfare state. And so I thought I'd put a couple of articles on tonight's syllabus about the Swedish welfare state from a couple of Swedish economists who have lived it and studied it and really who know what they're talking about. Peter Weiland is one of them. And so, and the first thing that the Swedish welfare state did, which is what supposedly America is supposed to be imitating as best as we can today, is it really destroyed the idea of self-sufficiency in that country. And there was a, just as in this country, but much more so than in this country, than in the United States, the idea of a welfare rights was accepted and became just an assumption of the entire generations now. And what this is about is you know, the original idea of rights that is that informed the American founding fathers and in their writing of such things as the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution was a type of freedom, definition of freedom that was called negative freedom, as freedom from government interference, for the most part. And so that's why so much of the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights in the U.S. Constitution, and today, by the way, December 15th is Bill of Rights Day in the United States. But anyway, the Bill of Rights, so much of it, at least prior to the Civil War, said government shall make no law, you know, blah, 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 doing this, abridging the freedom of speech, the right to bear arms, and these sorts of things. That's called negative freedom. But there's also an idea called positive freedom, that is associated with the idea of people should have the freedom to have things like a house and a job and a car. And this is expressed in Franklin Roosevelt's Economic Bill of Rights, which is on the web somewhere. FDR in the 1930s gave a speech in which he tried to transform the idea of freedom from negative freedom to positive freedom, where he said supposedly, you know, everyone deserves a good job, a nice house, you know, an education. And of course, to say that means that somebody else must be required with the threat of imprisonment to pay for it. That's called income taxation. And so this idea of positive freedom took hold very strongly and was just battered into the brains of school children in Sweden for many decades before it even became popular in the United States. And there's still a lot of opposition to this in the United States, thanks to the freedom movement that we still have here. But that movement is all but non-existent in a country like Sweden. And so that did a lot of damage. But that's a lesson for Americans and all other people, too, in that the welfare state is not just some collection of benign do-gooders who want to help the poor. Every government bureaucrat who has a job administering the welfare state is an inveterate propagandist for the welfare state. And this includes the public schools and other institutions of education, the universities, and so forth, because the welfare state cannot exist unless there's a series of beliefs that a large part of the public believed in regarding positive rights, for example. If the public comes to disbelieve in these things, then that spells big trouble for the welfare state. Now, one of the reasons why Sweden was able to finance a big welfare state was that it has not been involved in any war in any way since the year 1809. Sweden did not participate in World War I or World War II. And war always and everywhere ratchets up government spending, government debt, government taxes, regulations, conscription of all kinds, and is destructive of a nation's economy, even the winning nation in the war, because it is a massive diversion of resources from producing goods and services for consumption to producing armaments, bullets, and so forth for armies. They're all about blowing, bombing cities, killing people, and so forth. And so Sweden never participated in any of these wars, and so it did not squander a large part of its capital on war like other countries did. And so all during the late 19th century and the first half of the 20th century, Sweden was one of the fastest growing economies, capitalist economies in the world. Now, there are many inventions. There was a great deal of entrepreneurship. Alfred Nobel is one of the most famous Swedish entrepreneurs who invented dynamite, for example. And so Sweden was a very capitalistic society, but that was almost totally reversed beginning in a big way in the 1950s. Another thing that held sway in Sweden was that the idea that production should precede consumption was abandoned. Now, it's just common sense, wouldn't you think, that if you want to consume something, you first have to work and produce and earn money, and then you can use the money that you earn to buy things. That's the way the economic world works. But that flies in the face of Keynesianism, doesn't it? Keynesian economics, where we're told, well, we just need to spend. And it doesn't matter what you're spending on anything, just spending is good for the economy. Well, that just ignores the fact that we first have to invest and save and work and produce. Then we can spend. And then we can save some of the income that we have also. But you have to work first, you have to produce first. So Keynesianism or Keynesian economics is an attack on common sense in this regard. And it took hold in Sweden much more strongly than it did in the United States and earlier than it did in the United States. Keynesianism is a European idea, after all. Keynes was British. And so that's another thing that is relevant to Sweden. It is also, very prevalent here in the United States today also. I can remember shortly after the crash of 2008, an old Keynesian named Alice Riblett was on television quite a lot because she had a new book out, and she was giving the advice of the people of just go out and spend money on something. Doesn't matter what it is, even junk. If it's totally useless junk that you don't need, do your patriotic duty and waste your money on useless junk. And I even wrote an article or two about this, and I would add, useless junk like Alice Rivlin's books. That would be a good example of spending your money on useless junk. But that's Keynesianism in a nutshell, just ignoring production and thinking that we can just spend on a thin air. Another thing that happened in Sweden, a big part of the Swedish welfare state, was belligerent government-connected unions. And the unions were given all sorts of special preferences by law that empowered them over corporations. And as a result, for many, many years, they were able to, with strikes and the threat of strikes, increase wages much faster than productivity increased. And that is a recipe for making your economy unproductive and also unproductive in international markets. Because what this means, if wages increase faster than productivity, it means businesses can make money if they're paying somebody $10 an hour and that person is producing $12 an hour in revenue for the company. But if that person is being paid $20 an hour and is still producing only $12 an hour in revenue for that company, then the company is losing money on every hour that person is working. And that's basically what the powerful and belligerent labor unions in Sweden did for decades after, and decades, and therefore committed great damage to Swedish capitalism. They also adopted the idea of this, that nothing you do is your responsibility. That became the official social responsibility or social philosophy. And this is what the Obama administration is attempting to impose on Americans. When you hear Obama say things like, if you have a business, you didn't do that, you didn't start that, or we want to transform society. One of his appointees recently made a statement that people who are affluent because he said something like they're winners, winners of life's lottery. So that if you have a good income, it's just like you won a lottery somehow. It has nothing to do with the fact that you deferred consumption by educating yourself and working hard and long hours, took risks in your investment. It has nothing to do with that. You won life's lottery. And that's the European idea. That's the idea that's trying to be cemented in the minds of America's young people today. Nothing you do is your responsibility. And of course, if nothing you do is your responsibility, then the government needs to step in to assure fairness, doesn't it? And to assure that nobody gets, left back and lives in dire poverty for the rest of their lives because it's not their fault. That's the ideology of Swedish welfareism. Another thing that happened in Sweden is that children now are not raised by their parents. It has such a pervasive system of government-financed childcare that from birth, children are shunted off into daycare centers. And today we hear proposals for that in the United States. Hillary Clinton has been proposing this for 25 years getting children at a much earlier age. The government already gets them at age 4 or 5 in the government kindergarten and preschool. But now they want to get them pretty much from birth. And it's all sold in the name of egalitarianism. The argument is made that it's unfair for a wealthy parent to have a better quality daycare than a less wealthy parent. Therefore, the government, people who advocate this, want the government to force all children into the identical daycare, and so that they'll all start off in life evenly. That would mean harming the children of the more affluent people to ostensibly help the children of less affluent people. So it's egalitarianism gone crazy again. But that is the objective, and that is what has happened in Sweden. And so another thing that happened is that after several generations of this, that the young generation in Sweden today is utterly ignorant of economics, because you have to have wage war on economics and economic reasoning to get the public to acquiesce in Santa Claus economics. In the belief that there is sort of a tooth fairy out there that can give us just about everything for free and it will have no negative side effects. So in other words, you have to turn the minds of the public into the minds of children. You have to create an infantilization of society. And that's what has happened. Another thing that happened in the Swedish welfare state is the elderly are generally looked at as a huge burden with which the young have a right to be relieved of. Therefore, the government will take care of the elderly, not only through Social Security, but through a much more pervasive system of government subsidies and housing and medical care and things like that. Because the younger generations will say, well, it's unfair that we're burdened with taking care of mom and dad. And so that, of course, is extraordinarily destructive of the whole idea of family, the socialist socialization of family. And during during communism, one of Karl Marx's ideas is that a socialist man will be created along the way, and socialist man will no longer be acquisitive and interested in pursuing money, or selfishness will be banished. Socialist man. And that was always nonsense, of course. But places like Sweden have created welfare state man. They've created an attitude of people who are immature, irresponsible, dependent, and egotistical, and some of them are sort of egotistical monsters. You know, they want to dump their own parents on the state, let government bureaucrats take care of them because they have no concern whatsoever for them. And that's welfare state man, immature, irresponsible, always dependent, and egotistical, and the government plays into that. The government plays into that. And it's, so there was a remarkable transformation of the country of Sweden from the late 19th, early 20th century to the adoption of the welfare state in the 50s and 60s and after that. They had all these market reforms in the late 19th century that essentially made it one of the freest economies in Europe. And there was a tremendous burst of entrepreneurship and growth in that period, the late 19th century, was part of the Industrial Revolution in Europe. And of course, staying out of both wars in the 20th century was a huge benefit to the Swedes. And as a result of this, as a result of a relatively limited governments, relatively low taxes, the encouragement of entrepreneurship, and a moral attitude on the part of the vast majority of the public in favor of individual responsibility and work and thrift and savings and so forth, Sweden had the highest per capita income growth in the world from the year 1870 to 1950. So from the year 1870 to 1950, Sweden was the most rapidly growing economy in the entire planet. The Swedes weren't quite as wealthy as the Americans by the time they get to 1950, but they were catching up. They were growing more rapidly. And then there was a total reversal of this. With the adoption of the welfare state, there were taxes went up tremendously, government regulation went up tremendously, unions were given special powers by the government, inflationism reared its ugly head, and that caused boom and busts and recessions and depressions, so that the ratio of government spending to GDP, that is the proportion of the economy going to the government, in 1950 was 20%. By 1975, it was 50%. So it more than doubled. The proportion of the whole Swedish economy that went to government more than doubled in just 25 years. And that was the explosion of the welfare state. And so along with this was, you know, massive regulation of business. And they adopted a very harshly anti-business, anti-capitalist, pro-socialist attitude in the schools, in the primary and secondary education, universities, and the society as a whole, so that today the average Swede just hates capitalism, except for the Swedish capitalists who often come to the United States and elsewhere to be in business. And so all of this increase in taxes and inflationism and regulation caused recession and depression for about 20 years. From the 70s through the 90s, the Swedish economy tanked. And that caused a bit of a revolt. So they did have a revolt, so a bit of a tax revolt in Sweden, where the marginal tax rates were reduced. They got rid of currency control by the government. The banks were partially deregulated. There was even the privatization of quite a few nationalized industries, and the deregulation of industries in retail, airlines, and telecommunications. And that did produce a jump up in economic prosperity. And so the Swedish socialists, who were advocates of the welfare state, they took this, to mean that the welfare state is compatible after all with capitalism. So they used the fact that they had almost totally destroyed the capitalist part of their capitalist economy that was necessary to finance their welfare schemes. That was reversed. And with tax cuts and so forth, and they come back saying, well, see, we don't need the taxes anymore. We can just go about our merry way like we did for the previous 25 years and have our even bigger welfare state. And so today in Europe, you know, the welfare state is collapsing everywhere, while we in the United States are rushing headlong into trying to create a European-style welfare state. France is one of the worst examples of this, where in France it's almost impossible to be an entrepreneur in France because of government regulation. and the ordeal that one has to go through to get business licenses, and then the taxes that you have to pay, the extraordinarily high taxes. And capitalism is demonized everywhere in France. It's a very communistic culture that embraces the myth of Santa Claus economics, that the state can provide everybody something for nothing. France is very similar to the United States in that half the population pays no income tax. These are the tax eaters, the tax consumers, the people who get more from government in terms of subsidies than they pay in taxes. And they're about half the population now compared to the people who are the producers who pay income tax on the wages that they earn from being producers. And America is in pretty close to the same situation now as France. France has made it almost impossible to fire incompetent employees with civil service rules in the private sector. And as a result, very few people are hired. Because if you hire somebody who turns out to be just incapable of doing a job, it's impossible to get rid of them. And so you only hire the very, very, very best and brightest and who you're just certain will work out. And this, of course, means the people who are average, since most of us are average, have a very tough time of it. And if you're a little bit below average, then forget it. You might be put on permanent disability for the rest of your life, even though you don't have an actual disability. The government will give you disability payments anyway, just for being unemployable because of their own stupid policies. In addition to that, payroll taxes on employers, much of which are paid by employees, are so high that they can be double the actual salary that you pay. And so you might have to have out of pocket as an employer, you pay somebody, say, $40,000 a year, you might have to put up another $80,000 a year to the government in order to cover all the welfare state expenses for your employees and everybody else out there. And so the law of demand applies to labor markets like it does all markets. Anything that is made more expensive, people demand less of it. People want less of it. And so employers want fewer employees if they become more expensive. And they become more expensive by these so-called mandated benefits, which really should be called mandated costs of employment. And this is probably the main reason why France has had double-digit unemployment since the 1970s, over 10%, 10% or more is the norm since the 1970s. And of course, all of this is a part of France's version of the welfare state. And the taxes are so high to provide security, so-called. And so you don't really provide somebody with security, do you, by making it impossible for him to get a job. And that's what the French have done to millions of people. And so there have been riots in France also whenever politicians have recommended a very, very minor reduction in government welfare benefits. There's riots in the streets, which is why a lot of people are thinking that, well, that's probably going to happen here in the United States eventually, which it probably will, but no one can forecast or predict when that will happen. Okay. And so I think that's about all I wanted to say for now about the European welfare state and the myth of a successful European welfare state. So, they haven't been successful. They've produced all the pathologies that I've talked about in the first 2 weeks in spades, many times worse than even the United States, which is bad enough in terms of all the negative effects, the harm to the work ethic, the breakup of families, the destruction of capitalism. The Europeans got a head start on that. And so they're going to head start on the breakup of the welfare state and the bankrupting of their countries from it. And so far, it's money printing by the central banks and even the bailouts of European central banks by our central bank, by the Fed, that is propping the system up for now. But that's also creating boom and bust cycles in Europe and elsewhere that will create demands for an even bigger welfare state because it creates bigger unemployment problems in the future. So maybe that's all I'll do for now. And I'll do what we usually do and see if there are any questions or brilliant comments on the chat. I guess it must be a big football day today in America. We don't have that many attendees, live attendees. Again, there's no requirement for questions. Dennis mentioned that there's never any benchmark for failure for these programs. Well, that's true, but with all government programs, I think I called this DiLorenzo's first law of government, that failure is success. The worst the government does is reducing poverty, educating the children, taking care of the elderly, all the things it claims to be doing, the worst job it does, the more money it gives itself. Not the less money it gives itself, more money it gives itself. And so failure is rewarded with more money in government enterprises. If the kids aren't learning, the SAT scores are going down, well, it's because classrooms are too big. We need to hire more teachers, and we need to pay them more to get a better quality teacher, they will say. And that goes on decade after decade after decade. And the same with poverty programs. You know, in the United States today, I think we spend about $50,000 per family on welfare, per family of four on welfare and cash and in-kind benefits. And of course, if you would just write them a check for $50,000 a year, they would not be poor anymore. But that's considered success, I guess, that these people are stuck in as welfare recipients and have no incentive whatsoever to take a job. And so that's what they do. And so failure is success. Yeah, I think it looks like Cam found one of my old articles where I made this argument about DiLorenzo's laws of government. Well, any other questions? You don't have to have any questions. Like I said, well, maybe we'll just wrap it up then. We only have six attendees tonight. I guess other people are looking at the archives. Oh, here's another question popped up. And Robert is asking about Keynesian economics. Yes, Keynesian economics was refuted back in the 70s because it had no explanation for stagflation or the simultaneous increase of inflation and unemployment. Keynesianism always assumed that there was an inverse relationship, and when it failed to explain that, it was thought that that's the end. So the academic economics profession pretty much abandoned the Keynesian economics, but then you have sort of the political hacks like Paul Krugman who have been attempting to resurrect it, but the serious people in the economics profession abandoned Keynesianism in the 1970s. That's one of the reasons Friedrich Hayek was awarded the Nobel Prize in the 1970s, because he did have a theory that explained stagflation in a book called Prices and Production that was published in the year 1919. But politicians love Keynesian economics because it gives them an excuse, an intellectual cover for spending money that they don't have, for borrowing and printing money to buy votes with spending it on various constituencies. So the political system subsidizes those who espouse Keynesian ideas, even though they were thoroughly discredited by the events of the 1970s. Any other questions, comments? Okay, well, I guess we'll wrap it up then. Thanks again for participating, those of you who did. I hope you learned a few things. And we'll have a final class next week. It's about corporate welfare. And I've written several books on the subject of corporate welfare. And so I don't think it would be legitimate to teach class, even a short class like this, on welfareism without including at least one class on corporate welfareism. And so that'll be the subject of next week's class. And so have a great night.